Do you know what time it is? That question seems fairly easy. Of course, until you realize it depends on who you're asking. Someone in China or Nigeria or Canada would answer that question differently. It's not just where you are, it's also what you understand. Ask a little boy who's been promised ice cream if he will clean his room for 30 minutes, what time it is, and his answer inevitably will be as it relates to ice cream. Ask an historian what time it is, and they might answer we're in the late modern era, or maybe they would argue we're in the modern era. I'm not about to get philosophical this morning in this sermon, but I want to make the point that how you answer what time it is reveals your understanding about reality. Time is meant to correspond to what is real. Most generally, about your present relationship to the sun. Now, the Bible pushes us to move beyond that and to understand time as it relates to the revelation of the sun. In God's world, in this world that has everything from Ramadan to Diwali, the calendar is not casual. Understanding what time it is a matter of eternal consequence. This morning, we're going to think about what time it is. And we do so as we go into the book of Hebrews. Just a little introduction. Most likely, this book was written to Christians from Jewish backgrounds. There are, as many of you know, arguments for different authors. An early church father said it best about the authorship. Origen said, God only knows. Hebrews is a letter. If you look at chapter 13, verse 22, the writer says this is a brief word of exhortation. And the book is concerned to demonstrate to tired, weak Christians the supremacy of Jesus. For angels and prophets and priests over everything that has come before. That Jesus is the substance to the shadows. Jesus is the completion of all that is incomplete. And therefore, this letter calls you to keep trusting him, to not fall away. It's a complicated book. But for all that you find complicated about it, Philip Hughes writes that Hebrews is a tonic for the spiritually debilitated, tired, weak, sick. So this morning, we begin applying the medicine of Hebrews to our minds and our hearts and our lives in the first four verses. In these four verses is the substance of the whole letter. And in them, the writer tells us what time it is. Not as it relates to the revolution around the sun, but the revelation of the sun. So here's the main point. These four verses, listen to the sun. Because he is God's last word in these last days. Listen to the sun. Because he is God's last word in these last days. Friends, if you are to understand the world, you must understand the time. The coming of God's Son has changed time forever.
So, if you come needing to see the supremacy and the glory of the all-sufficient Jesus,
Hebrews is for you. Let's read these four verses.
Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom also he created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. And he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Having become as much superior to angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs.
2 points this morning: God's speech and God's Son. God's speech, God's Son. Beginning first, God's speech. Verse 1 through the first part of verse 2, God's speech. Hebrews 1 to 2a. Hebrews is unique as a letter in that it doesn't begin with a salutation, no greetings. Hebrews begins with an assertion. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets.
So the very first assertion that should astonish us, but which we are very tempted to read right on past, is that the God who is spoke. The God who is self-sufficient, who needs nothing outside of himself, has spoken. His speech is an act of self-revelation, of disclosure. And by his speech, by his words, God created the world. By his words, God gave the boundary lines for the first man and woman. It was what God said, its truthfulness, its goodness, its trustworthiness that was at stake in that garden when mankind fell into sin. It was by his word that he calls Abram out of Ur, and by his word that he creates his people at Sinai. It's by his word that he forms his people and sustains his people through the prophets. In Hebrews, we are immediately confronted with the speaking God. So to this world that downplays God's word and denies God's word, Hebrews says, God is not silent. And so, to live rightly in this world does not fundamentally demand that you have great intellectual ability, but humility to listen, to understand, to receive and believe what God has said. By his words, he created reality. And by his speech, he defines reality. His words give life. His words give good boundary lines for our lives in this world. When I was growing up and I was childishly and foolishly not paying attention to what my dad was saying, what would my mom say? Your father is speaking. And I got the point. Hebrews begins ensuring we get the point. God spoke. And we're meant to listen. He spoke long ago. The point is not this was the distant past. The point is that was a different era, a different time. From the creation of the world to Christ coming into the world, God's speech determined and defined the world. Now, all of us, different nations that we come, inevitably remember people and events that have shaped our national histories, that have shaped us. The Hebrews, whose entire way of seeing and understanding the world had been shaped by what God spoke to them long ago in that covenantal era. What God spoke necessarily defined their lives individually and their life together. It shaped their hopes. It shaped what they expected. And yet, God's speaking in that long ago different era was incomplete. Not inferior, incomplete. Because God's speech necessitated, it demanded completion. God spoke long ago in a different era, and he spoke to a very specific audience, our fathers. So God was not just disclosing himself to anyone. He gave it to the forefathers of the Hebrews, to the exclusion of the world. They had the revelation of God. And God spoke through a specific medium, the prophets. So from Abraham to Moses to Samuel to David and Isaiah and many others, God gave his word to his people. And many times and in many ways. Through history and through poems and through wisdom. Again and again in that former era, God spoke. And we would be arrogant to think we don't need to understand what God said long ago. We read the Old Testament, we preach the Old Testament because God spoke there. And the way to come to know God is through his word, to come to know his character and his ways, beginning with Adam, to Abraham, to all of his descendants. What God's people did with God's speech mattered. And the same is true for us. In the past, God spoke. But God didn't stop there. First part of verse 2. But God has spoken again. And the emphasis is who God spoke by. In the past, the prophets, now by his son. And what he has said in his son is final. It is definitive. It is conclusive. In contrast to long ago, God has spoken in these last days. So the magnitude of God's speech by his son is seen in the fact that through the Son, God changed the time. The time is different. Now that God has spoken by his Son between his resurrection and his return, we live in these last days. He is God's last word to the world. The life and the death and the crucifixion, the resurrection, the ascension of the Son has changed time. God's speech in his Son is climactic. It demands our attention. In this speech, he spoke not to our fathers, but to us. We live in a more privileged position than we can fathom. We live in the days in which the God who spoke long ago in many times and in many ways now has given his word to his people by becoming one of his people. In these last days, the word has taken on flesh. We have the once for all definitive word from God that has changed time. The Son, he is the climax and the culmination of God's speech. The Son is the medicine, the help, the life for the spiritually debilitated. So from the outset, Hebrews means for you to see the Son, but not to stop there. Hebrews means for you to see everything,
by the Son, your times and the time itself. Now, are you satisfied with that? Are you astonished by that? Or do you want to move beyond that? Where has God disclosed himself? In his Son. So if God's speech by his Son has changed the time, if God means for the world to understand him and his speech through his Son, this means there is enough there such that our brief lives will not exhaust it. There is enough wisdom, joy, life, glory in the Son that we can keep gazing and gazing and beholding the Son. The revelation of God in the Son is more than enough for your rejoicing. And the rejection of God in the Son is the clearest evidence of the world's rebellion. We don't move beyond God's speech in his Son. We stand there. We go deeper there. This letter is meant to raise your gaze and your joy, your rejoicing and your resting in the Son. Now, depending on the background you come from, you might think that's narrow. You might ask, aren't there many ways to God? Surely there is the light of God and other religions and other revelation. But if you react that way, you're missing the point. The shock should not be that God's speech has been narrow. The shock should be that God spoke freely and graciously at all. In the light of the guilt of this world, God spoke. And his speech is always undeserved. His speech is always gracious. After his word was defied and it was disobeyed, God spoke again until ultimately his Son veiled his glory, took on flesh, and entered into the space and the time of our world. And in view of this, Hebrews says to anyone who would mock the idea that God's speech can only be known in this one way, is the true shock is that God has spoken at all. To a guilty world, God did not ultimately give a message or a messenger. God gave and spoke by his Son. And he did not stutter, and he did not stumble in this speech. And so God's speech will always be misunderstood or mishandled or misplaced unless it is understood and delighted in view of God's Son. Whatever form it takes, as if this didn't happen, or to foolishly live in rebellion against it. It's all foolishness. When the writer says that God first spoke by the prophets, but now by the Son, the former revelation was not less. It was not faulty. The movement here is from promise to fulfillment, from shadow to substance. In God's speech, his revelation, he didn't just dump down a book all at once. He spoke over time. He revealed himself progressively. And we learn more as God discloses more. But God himself has never changed. By his speech and through those who spoke it, God was moving history to his Son, and in these last days, all of life and history must be understood as flowing from the Son, whose life and work ushered in the end of the ages into this present age. So these last days aren't times for panic. They are times for praise, because they are the last days, because all of God's saving promises have been fulfilled in the Son. Prior revelation must be understood in light of the Son, and any claim of future revelation must be judged in light of the Son. We all know that the times of each of our lives can be so perplexing, but most fundamentally,
We live in the time in which God has spoken by his Son. Hear that again. We have heard God's sure word in his Son. We live in this age of great fulfillment. We are not in an age of shadows. We are in the age of substance. We are so spiritually privileged. In the Son, we have clarity. We have certainty from God. We can be confident that as we hear and receive what God has spoken by his Son, we're not lost. Of all people, because of God's speech, we really do understand what time it is. We most fundamentally understand the times. This is a wonder of wonders. God has spoken, and by his speech, he can be known and he can be believed and trusted. His word has never failed his people. Not those who went before, not us. We are those on whom the end of the ages has dawned. This is a great letter of exhortation. There is so much at stake in the lives of those who receive this letter, and it begins by drawing who were very tired, weak Christians to the authority of God's speech and the sufficiency of God's speech, culminating in God's Son. And that's where the writer takes us next. From God's speech, we gaze at God's Son. That's the second point. Second part of verse 2 all the way to verse 4. I don't think this affects how we understand the letter, but it's most probable that the original recipients of the letter were Christians from Jewish backgrounds in Rome. May not be true, but most likely. In Hebrews 13, verse 24, the writer says, those who come from Italy greet you, causing most to think the recipients were in Rome. The point is, in Rome, Judaism was a recognized legal religion. Christianity was a very new sect. It did not have the same status. And you can imagine what it was like to live as a Christian in that world. Persecution. Passed over for jobs. Because of Jesus, you had suffered physically or economically or socially, but also spiritually. And the temptation of the very real people who received this letter was to go back to the temple, back to the priests, to the rituals that had so rightly in that different era defined the life of God's people. But to go back was to go back to shadows when the substance had come. It's like looking at a picture of your wife when your wife is sitting right there. And so the writer wonderfully invites us to gaze at the glory of the Son, his attributes and his achievements. It's one thing for the writer to say, God spoke by his Son. It's another thing to prove it. And it's in these very few verses we see why what God said through the Son is cosmically consequential. Who is God's Son? He's not one of many. He is one of one. To prove this, we're given seven propositions, statements, assertions about the Son that give solid ground to your faith and your affections. Who is God's Son? He is, the end of verse 2, the heir of creation, the agent of creation. For centuries, God's people had read Psalm 2, verse 8. They knew it well. A psalm in which the Davidic king, the Lord's anointed, is promised, ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of earth your possession. It had just hung there. With the Son, it's heightened. He is the Davidic king who, according to his human nature, does not just inherit the earth. He inherits all things. The world to come. It's certain, but it awaits completion. And the Son, who is the heir, think of this, did not keep his inheritance to himself. The Son has gone ahead of all things for those who will inherit all things with him. The fact that the Son will inherit all things means, Christian, there are future realities worth waiting for, worth believing, worth enduring in light of. In the creation of the universe, God had in part this great end in view to give the universe, the world to come, to his Son, the Messiah, the Davidic King who has been appointed the heir and the agent. The Son is the one through whom God created the world. We also don't know the exact date that Hebrews was written. I think there's good reason to believe it was written sometime in the 60s AD. The point is, within the lifetime of the writer, Jesus of Nazareth was publicly, shamefully humiliated by being crucified on a Roman cross. Not only is this not skipped over in this letter, it's brought to the forefront. Friends, it is unthinkable that this Jesus is the one praised as the agent of creation, the one who suffered so publicly before the world on the cross is the one through whom God created the world. Don't lose your astonishment at the depths of the condescension of God the Son, and therefore your astonishment at the heights of his exaltation. The universe itself, far from being the product of impersonal forces, creation was personal. The destiny of the universe is personal. Jesus' own teaching reflected this. This vast universe, people just came back from going around the moon. Not a sparrow falls to the ground apart from the care of our Father. He knows the very numbers of your head. One commentator rightly said, the more science discovers about the universe, the more marvelous the thought that Christ is the agent through whom it was made. The God who has spoken by his Son, has created by his Son, and is giving it all to his Son. So you can't make sense of life in this world apart from God's Son. He is the key that unlocks the meaning. He is the one for and from whom it all exists. And think of this, God has not disclosed this to those of great rank or position or power, but to those who simply trust him, to those who take him at his word. From the role of the Son that he's played in creation to his ultimate inheritance of all that belongs to him, we move then in verse 3 to the Son's relationship to the Father. He is the radiance of the glory of God, the exact imprint of his nature. Hebrews can assert that God has spoken by his Son because in Jesus the glory of God radiates brilliantly. Perfectly. Not an idea unique to Hebrews. This stands behind all of Jesus's life and ministry in John's gospel. He tells us Jesus is the Word who was with God and is God, is the one through whom all things were made. And in taking on flesh, John declares, we have seen his glory. Glory as of the only Son from the Father. Jesus did not achieve this. He was this. He is this. So I was in Abu Dhabi last week, and I was up very early on Sunday morning, and we were staying in a hotel, and we were on the 20th floor, and I looked out the window and just stared at an amazing sunrise. It came up over that city, and I just watched slowly as its rays went forward. Ever so slowly, darkness being pierced. And the rays of the sun, though they are distinct, cannot be separated from the sun itself. So in the sun, in Jesus, like a sunrise on an early morning, God is radiating his glory to the world. Now, I want you to think of all the ways God radiated his glory to the world before Jesus. This is the God who created the universe from nothing. This is the God who publicly, before the world's superpower, redeemed his people by splitting open the Red Sea. This is the God who came in a theophany at Mount Sinai. This is the God who filled the temple with his glory. And yet not one of those events is it said they were the radiance of the glory of God. That's the privileged position of God's Son, in whom the Father has been personally made known. And he is the exact imprint of his nature. This exact imprint language describes the mark of something on an object, like on a coin. Now, we all know we live in a place that loves stamps. A document here is not official until it has the stamp. And what does a stamp require? You need a stamp machine that has that logo on it. And when you press it down, it is reflecting. It's the exact representation of a logo. You get the point. It's not the exact imprint, your document's not getting accepted. You know, even when we say like father, like son, and we're speaking of a father and his son, we are falling short because what we're speaking of is similarities. Similarities. In this divine father-son relationship, there is sameness. Peter O'Brien comments, in Jesus is the substance, the real essence of the Father. This is the assertion. This is the reality. In Jesus, we see what is unthinkable and blasphemous unless it is true. In Jesus, God is embodied in the flesh. And this is what Jesus taught his disciples. They staked everything on this belief. And I want to be clear, this wasn't an obscure teaching. John 14, Philip asked Jesus, "Show us the Father." Jesus did not respond with surprise that Philip would ask such a preposterous question. He responded with surprise that Philip didn't already know the answer. "Have I been with you so long, and you still do not know me, Philip? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father." He expected his disciples to know this and stake their lives on this reality. And he knew and understood his opponents would stake their opposition on that reality. Jesus wasn't crucified for being nice. He was crucified because he claimed in himself the world sees the substance, the sameness of the Father. So as been so rightly said, there is no God in heaven who is unlike Jesus. If you want to know what God is like, if you want to know what the Father is like, look at Jesus. Study him. Like the stamp on the page, he is the exact imprint in radiating the glory of God. He is caring in his very nature because Jesus is God. This is why we can be unshakably confident in these last days. God has spoken to us by his Son. And because of who he is by his nature, the Son is uniquely qualified to reveal God to the world. He's uniquely qualified to mediate between God and man. And so as this writer who writes to this congregation of weak and tired and probably confused Christians, he's not saying, "Summon up the strength to keep going." He is taking them to the summit, the heights of the glory of Christ, so that they might see his glory and those who had been united with him might know that they are in a more privileged position in the universe than they can fathom. And that hasn't changed. Brothers and sisters, think what spirit dwells within you. Think what Father's smiles are thine. Think what Jesus died to win you. In seeing the Son, you are seeing who the true God is, what he's like,
And that's more precious than anything the world can give you. It's more precious than anything the world will ever take away. By faith in the Son, you are united to Him and you have a claim on Him. And there's even more. The Son upholds the universe by the word of His power. So the universe created through the pre-existent Son is upheld by the Son. Don't confuse this with Atlas, the Greek god who is pictured as holding the weight of the universe on his shoulders. This is not a passive act of the Son. It is active. It is an active bearing up of the universe to bring all things to their appointed end. So if we understand who the Son is, we saw that the universe, all of creation, is cosmically personal. It is by understanding His upholding that we see that the universe is cosmically purposeful. This is not a world created by a deistic God who has wound up the watch and is just letting it run. The universe is being actively upheld and carried forward towards God's glorious ends in the Son. The same word which has created the world is bringing the world to its very ends. So I want you to see what this does for your faith. Day by day, you press forward in faith because you believe in the One who is purposely moving the universe to glorious ends. And that should cause your heart to soar as you wrestle with what is confusing or seems random or defeating. Not in this universe. The Son's upholding of the universe means that your fight of faith and your fight for faith and faithfulness in very ordinary stewardships that mark our lives have consequences that are beyond what we can fathom at the moment. Because we live in this universe that is irreversibly moving toward God's purposes in His Son, and we cannot fathom the glory and the extent of that. In this moment, I think one of the great glories to come, of the world to come, will be seeing how the very little pieces, the little tapestries of our lives, all fit together for these glorious ends. So the writer, Hebrews, means to take us to the summit of God's glory so that we will live faithfully in the ordinary circumstances of our lives. And yet, notice this, the Son who carries forward the universe to His purposes has not failed to attend to the most personal needs of men. From the heights of the Son upholding the universe by the word of His power, we move to the Son's definitive achievement, making purification for sins. This is the great justification, juxtaposition. The One who upholds the universe has come personally near to purify sinners from sin. We live in a world that thinks so differently about sin. Much of the world, generally the West, but some of the atheist parts of the East, just dismiss any notion of guilt or sin altogether. It's laughable, it's primitive to think of moral categories and absolutes, especially sin before a holy God. But I think the majority of the world still lives under systems that are deeply concerned with purification, purifying themselves in some way. And in that, whatever form it takes, it requires effort and human dedication on the part of the one who wants to be clean. And at the very outset of this letter, Hebrews asserts that Jesus has achieved what no other person or system has. He's writing to people who knew their Bibles. They didn't just know Leviticus, they lived it. And they knew the great problem of approaching God. They lived the purification rituals that had been enacted and lived for centuries. And this is a world-altering, destiny-changing assertion. The Son made definitive purification for sins. This is not just forgiveness. If you purify something, you actually make it clean. This is the difference between the house that looks neat and tidy, but it is disgusting once you start to just dig a little bit. To put it in very plain language, it's the difference between how kids make their rooms look and how their room actually is most of the time. This letter is at pains to make clear that by his sacrifice, Jesus has cleansed, he's purified all who trust him. It's not just a little tidying up. He cleanses people down to their conscience. This is the achievement of the Son. The Son alone. This is the gospel. Jesus can cleanse you deeply. He means to purify what we and our sin have made terribly dirty. We stand guilty before God. And there's no amount of our human effort or our sacrifice, our atonement. There's no ritual we can perform. There's no amount of good deeds that we can add up to cleanse us. But because of who Jesus is as the Son, his sacrificial death on the cross, he was, as this letter says, able to save completely. Now, where are you? You dismiss sin as silly? Are you striving in some way because you believe you can do just enough, even just a little bit, to make yourself right with God? Whichever way you fall, you are failing to grasp who the Son is and what the Son has done. His achievement is the singularly most important achievement in the world. He purified sin and sinners through a sacrificial death on the cross. And the cross is saying to the world, stop striving, stop working, believe. Come with nothing in your hands to Jesus, and he will cleanse you. That is astonishing. This is the Jesus held out in Hebrews. He suffered and he is exalted. He sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. This Son who accomplished a history-defining, history-changing work on earth goes back into heaven. And when he went there, he went as the exalted king and he sat down. This is what so much of this book will argue. Suffering than exaltation. The Son who died and sacrificed is exalted. He is the King to whom the Lord said in Psalm 110, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. The Son is exalted at the right hand of the Father. He shares the Father's throne. He is in the unique position of special honor in the universe. Think of the glory of the Son. This introduction began by asserting the Son is superior to, he surpasses the prophets. And it ends in verse 4, asserting he is superior to and surpasses the angels. The name that he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. These original readers rightly had a very high view of angels. It's wrong to think that Jesus is on the same level of the angels. The name he inherited, Son, is more excellent. It wasn't that he wasn't Son before. It's by virtue of what he achieved as God in the flesh, the God-man, that his present position in the universe demands our hearing and our honoring. God's speech by God's Son. The unique glory and person and position of God's Son, whose attributes and achievements put him in a category of one. He alone is worthy of being God's final, definitive word to the world. Hebrews begins by holding out God's Son to you. It begins by holding up for us, by painting a picture and inviting us to stare at Jesus and to rest in Jesus. So as we go on into Hebrews,
a book of great theology, this is what you must know. You cannot possibly think high enough of Jesus. Why? Because of who he is and what he accomplished, he is of infinite worth. And for you to think as high a thought as that requires, you must have an infinite thought. And that's not possible. This is why all of eternity will never exhaust his praises. For all of eternity, you're never going to grow bored gazing at the glory of Jesus, of praising the wonderful Son. So if you know that your soul needs life and strength, here is the tonic. Here is the help. God's Son. God's Son. For there is nothing and no one better that can be given. In him, you're cleansed. In him, you see the radiance and the exact representation of God. You see the one upholding the universe, the one who has gone into the heavens and has sat down, because the work of salvation is finished. In Hebrews, we're meant to believe and to be transformed as we see that Jesus is better. We are meant to be confident such that we persevere in believing, not just because it will be wise, because this is the greatest delight our souls can know. God's speech will never be understood if it is disconnected from God's Son, and neither can your life in this world. By the Son and in the Son, the time has changed. We know what time it is. By the Son, in the Son, the end of the ages has come into the present age. For all that seems complicated about Hebrews, the book is simply holding out Jesus to you. He's more than enough to comfort you and to cleanse you, to save you and to satisfy you forever.